The New Quantum Era,
a podcast
by Sebastian Hassinger
and Kevin Roney.
Welcome to another episode of The New Quantum Era. Today, we're going to be having a conversation with Natalie De Leon, who is very well known for her research in color centers, also known as diamond vacancies. She's a professor at Princeton University. These diamond vacancies are a really fascinating platform for quantum information science and engineering applications. And Kevin, I was really struck by, you know, it was great. Natalie shared with us some of her background and her journey to becoming, a quantum information, quantum physicist, and being in the field of quantum computing. And as usual, everybody we've spoken to has a very non-determinate path to get to where she's gone.
Complex path, yes. No, it really struck me how vulnerable and humble she was about it. She's now like top of the heap, a tenured professor at Princeton. But it was an arduous journey, so impressive.
That's right. Not only tenured professor, but also a recent awardee of the American Physical Society Rolf Landauer and Charles M. Bennett Award.
Dang, yeah. And that was and our cool new science paper comparing all those different methods. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, she's done some great work. And at some point, some future episode, we're going to have to dig into Rolf Landauer and Charles Bennett because they are seminal figures in the development of the field. So that those names being associated with that award make it a pretty big deal. So we'll in this discussion, we'll learn more from Professor De Leon about her work in material science generally. And as I said, with her background and how she got to how her career sort of developed, and also some more recent experimental use of tantalum for superconducting qubits in the place of more commonly used niobium, which is really interesting.
Interesting breakthroughs, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Terrific. So with no further ado, here we go. So we are joined today, where we have the distinct pleasure in having with us Natalie De Leon. She's the Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Princeton, and the Associate Faculty in the Princeton Center for Complex Materials, and very recently winner of the American Physical Society Rolf Landauer and Charles Bennett Award. So congratulations, Natalie, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Would you mind starting just with a brief introduction, and especially we're always super interested in hearing how people sort of found their way into the field of quantum technologies, because it's rarely a linear route is what we found.
Yeah, sure. So let's see. Well, the way that I would normally tell the story of my group is that, we spent several years working on technology, quantum technologies based on diamond. So we use NV centers in diamond, and we discovered a couple of other color centers in diamond. And the idea is, mostly to use them in things like quantum sensing and quantum communications networks. And while we were doing that, because what I like to do is orient my group towards a particular, let's say, long-term, hopefully not so long-term technological goal, then what that requires you to do is solve a lot of problems at sort of different levels, right? You can't just live inside of device integration. You sort of have to do device integration and think about new protocols and think about how you're going to integrate these different pieces together, like more of a systems architecture picture, but also drill down into the material side, and say like, well, what are the real problems? And what we kept on bumping into on both of those things was just, materials and surfaces were a real problem. So then, after kind of drilling, accidentally becoming surface scientists in a variety of contexts, what we discovered was that that was a playbook that's actually quite powerful. And then I ended up working on superconducting qubits just in the last couple of years because of basically from that vantage point. I think if you had asked me when I became a faculty member if I was going to be working in quantum computing, I would have said no, like you had said something mildly offensive.
Oh, that's good.
You know, like, only crazy people would say that they're working on fault-tolerant quantum computers. Yeah. So, and I think that was probably true of actually quite a few people who started their groups around that era, which was not that long ago. I've only been on faculty for 6.5 years. I think people had a general sense that there are interesting things you can do with large quantum systems, but they would have sold their work as quantum many body physics or, you know, particular applications. And I think it was still considered sort of a fool's errand to try to build a big quantum computer. And obviously the world has changed really rapidly just in the last few years. So it is funny that I'm like now very like deep into the territory of, okay, guys, what's it going to take? Like, how are we going to make our first logical qubit? So that's been like a new trajectory.
That's really interesting. I mean, was there a key moment in your the landscape of what was happening that had you sort of get to a conversion towards being a believer, or was it a gradual persuasion?
I did not say I'm a believer.
Maybe. Ken Brown said to me, every year they say it's impossible, and every year the quality goes up by another order of magnitude. And so, you know, until somebody proves to me it's not possible, I'm just going to keep plugging away.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm just enough of a grumpy academic to not ever claim to be a true believer in anything. But I am significantly more optimistic now than even maybe just like 18 months ago. You know, I think my perspective on this is shifting pretty rapidly. I guess there's, you know, there's the question of like, do you ever build something that you can do Shor's algorithm on? And there, maybe I'm still skeptical.
We're a long way. Yeah.
But then there's this other question of like, is there a lot of interesting stuff you can do with pretty big systems before that? And I think there now I'm willing to say that I'm a true believer that I think there are interesting things, you know, that there's, it's a rich space.
Is it fair to say that the promise you're seeing is sort of more aligned with like Feynman's original sort of the keynote in 81 saying, you know, that you can do simulations of natural systems that are quantum in nature that you can't do via classical means if you can build a sufficiently powerful quantum system?
I don't want to get myself into too much trouble with my skepticism about quantum simulation.
So we won't interrogate you. We were just looking for at least some nuance.
Okay. So I think there's a few things that have sort of changed my mind about this, and a couple of them are serious points, and one of them is maybe a little bit snarky. So the serious point is that, okay, for a long time, in terms of error correction, you know, we had like Shor's code or whatever, and it just seemed like the resources were so high and the thresholds were so ridiculous that just nobody was ever going to be able to do that. And then there was, you know, the surface code and all of this topological stuff, and then that pushed the thresholds up a little bit. And then, to me at least, I have a very naive, not super expert perspective on these things. I think the fact that people started playing around with really weird quantum computers in the last 10 years, like this bosonic stuff that Rob Schulkoff and Steve Gerbin and Michel Devoret have really pioneered. It just opened up this creativity in like architecture and how you think about these problems. And then, you know, that busted open this bias noise stuff with error correction, where suddenly the thresholds were way different. And it just feels like things are suddenly, you know, moving very rapidly. And, you know, locally at Princeton, full disclosure, this is my husband's work that I'm going to talk about. But
so you can't trash it completely.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man, I have to hear about it constantly. No, but it is very exciting. I mean, he pointed out something that is somewhat simple, but I think, you know, a lot of the most elegant things are really simple, which is that, you know, in classical error correction, the best kind of error you can have is an erasure error, where you just know that something is corrupted, and then you can just throw it out and replace it. And he just pointed out that if you could do a quantum version of erasure correction, erasure conversion, then you can actually get extremely high thresholds. So to me, it just feels like all this stuff happened in such a short period of time, you know, and that if you had asked me like 5 or 6 years ago, I would have been deeply skeptical, because I'm just like, look at all these smart guys who haven't been able to move the needle.
Well,
and this.
Your point about creativity is a really powerful one. I think that I feel like error correction is chief among the areas, but there are many areas within quantum computing where we won't know. The answer to these challenges won't be obvious until after the fact, right? I mean, we'll go like, oh, of course it was that all along. But it's going to take this very, very open-ended creative exploration of the space and openness to just a whole bunch of crazy ideas. Because, I mean, you know, we're on this side of an unknown, discontinuous kind of breakthrough. And so, you know, everything looks possible. You know, it's plausible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we should be open to totally crazy architectures that don't look anything like classical computers, right? And things that we're familiar with.
Or even current precedent in quantum computing, yeah.
The challenge is the rootedness in the architectures and the history of classical computing, in a sense, because it's like just replicating what we did for classical definitely will not work. And yet the whole industry and a large part of academia are still sort of anchored in those ideas in some ways.
Right. Like people just feel good inside if you can just map it to silicon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So Natalie, we were doing a little tangent there on, you know, your perspectives of what led to your improved optimism, so to speak, on on quantum information processing. But we maybe interrupted your description of your entry into the field. I just want to make sure that we were all done hearing a little bit about your background biography before we move on to the rest of the agenda.
Oh, yeah, sure. So my entry into this field and science in general is like probably pretty weird compared to a lot of people in the field. So I was a chemist as an undergrad. I was a spectroscopist working for Dick Zare, who had this, you know, amazing lab with all of these different kinds of spectroscopy. And the thing that I really learned from Dick is that he was just totally fearless about disciplinary boundaries. He didn't see it as, we're a group that does this, so you have to do this, or we're not going to do that because that's not what chemists are interested in. But he just saw it as like, look, there's this problem. Let's just throw everything we can.
We have skills. Let's attack it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's get new skills to attack, you know? And so that was really cool, environment to grow up in. And then in my PhD, I went to go work for Hongkun Park, and my PhD is in chemical physics, which is sort of this like hybrid, degree. And Hongkun had a very similar attitude. I mean, he did his PhD with Dick, so it maybe all just comes from one family line or something, where he was also, you know, he didn't necessarily see the world as, we have to do this thing because it's what our group is good at. But instead he was always sort of hunting for the interesting problems. And there were sort of two formative experiences in Hongkun's group. One was that after he got tenure, which was like right before I joined, he decided that he wanted to become a neuroscientist, just out of nowhere. And he went and, you know, shifted over the time that I was there, something like half of his effort towards a pretty serious biology lab. You know, like they culture neurons, they do a lot of stuff.
Sounds fun. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was very cool. And then the other formative experience was that I joined his group to do a specific project, which was that I was working on electronic transport in 1D systems and 0D systems. So we were doing things like wiring up nanowires and individual molecules, and then trying to use that as a tool to, you know, look at specific condensed matter phenomena, and also as a tool for doing molecular spectroscopy. And, you know, honestly, none of that stuff worked very well. The molecule stuff was a really tough project.
Challenging area, we've heard. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And Hongkun was, you know, he had gotten really famous basically inventing that technique. Like he was the person who came up with this method for wiring up single molecules. And in my second year of grad school or something like that, or third, he decided, I don't want to do these experiments anymore. I don't think they're going anywhere. I think it would be better for you if you didn't finish your PhD doing the same thing. So we're just going to cut it off. And I was the last person with a cold dilution refrigerator in his group. And then I was in the desert for a year or two, working on kind of random things that I didn't really know what the rest of my PhD would look like. And I guess I have tenure now, so I can just say this publicly. Hongkun doesn't know all of these pieces, but I thought about dropping out of grad school and, I had a latent interest in policy and economics. So I thought maybe just go nurture that.
Maybe you just go on a total tangent. Yeah, right.
Yeah. I even did some consulting work for a venture capital firm.
Oh, wow.
And tried to leave academia entirely, all somewhat surreptitiously. And then, but then eventually where I landed was we started working on, nanophotonics and plasmonics. And then that took me to that finished out my PhD. I was working on making these little resonators, and I started collaborating with Misha Lukin's group and trying to do quantum optics experiments. And then, so that was my entry point to atomic physics and quantum optics. So I basically didn't do any of that stuff until I was 26. and then that's the starting point for everything that I'm doing now.
See, I told you, everybody has a circuitous route into this.
It's true. But it's such a great story as well, Natalie, is that you lost to the desert for a little while. Now you're at the summit of Princeton. I mean, to your faculty. I mean, wow. I mean, it's quite a journey.
It's great.
I mean, a lot of grad students get lost, I mean, way to go.
I wouldn't recommend it to anyone because it's not an easy place to be in. But I do think I emerged from it probably the same way that people emerge from getting lost in the woods, like they could outrun bears or something.
Made you stronger. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Exactly. I sort of understood a little bit better how to pick problems. And just how to think more broadly about problems, right? Because it was the first time that I didn't have an advisor who just handed me a pre-baked thing.
Like marching orders. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting.
It was a tough time, but it was an interesting time.
Well, and thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, it's not an easy story maybe to remember, but yeah.
That's great. And so circling back to what you were saying about error correction, and even before that, where you were talking about sort of thinking about device integration and protocols and what are the real problems in materials is, I'm just curious, you're sort of so far down in the stack, you're lower down in the stack in terms of materials than we typically, Kevin and I talk to people who are typically higher up, they're building systems or they're building software or they're exploring algorithms. How far up the stack does your sort of interest lie, and how does that inform what you're doing down at the materials level?
Yeah, well, I guess I started my exposition about why I'm optimistic by saying that I had three things to share. So I think I only did one of them. So the first serious point was that error correction is moving really rapidly. The second serious point is that I heard a series of talks that I actually found really fascinating. Sarang Gopalakrishnan and Vedika Kamani going around talking about the fact that, in some sense, fault tolerance is a phase transition, is a quantum phase transition, right? That you have a fundamentally different system before and after you turn on your error correction. And that just really, that's just amazing. That just feels like now suddenly such a rich fundamental physics field. And then similarly, Umesh Vazirani likes running around saying that, it's sort of an open question whether or not the universe really uses all of Hilbert space, right? Most things that we see are in a very tiny fraction of Hilbert space. So in some sense, you can sort of ask this fundamental question about whether or not we really have all of this Hilbert space by building a fault-tolerant quantum computer, right? Because there's no way for it to work without having explored all of this. So I feel like there's, we're just barely scratching the surface of some of the really deep questions. And it's interesting because all of these pieces have been in front of us all along, right? We've been able to think about them since, the 90s. But I think it's just you're in a really different world when people start building big systems. It's just a different ecosystem, and it makes people think about things differently. Okay, those are the two serious points. The snarky point is that I started sniffing around. So, you know, we did the stuff in NV centers where we were really working on trying to make shallow NV centers with really long spin coherence times, and you have all this surface noise. And the headline result was that we could do the surface processing to get about an order of magnitude or even two orders of magnitude extension in the spin coherence. So my group now just does this for a living. Like we can routinely make substrates that have like the only coherent shallow NV centers in the world. So we're just now doing that all the time. And I ran around giving that seminar saying like, okay, here's how we did it. And here, and then people would come up to me after my seminar and say like, hey, do you want to try to solve anomalous heating in trapped ions? Or you know, in quantum dots, we have all this weird charge noise that we don't understand. Why don't you come and help us figure out what the charge noise in quantum dots is? And in superconducting qubits, you have all of this dielectric loss, and nobody knows where that dielectric loss is from. And I would always just demur and say, like, look, I'm not going to be like the sheriff that rolls into town
and cleans up some mess.
Yeah, exactly. And tells everyone how to fix their surfaces. That is not my role in life. That's not how I want to spend my time.
Sounds like a hard job. Maybe thankless too. Yeah, I don't know.
But then the way that I ended up getting kind of nerd sniped into this topic was that we were talking with a bunch of collaborators while we were forming our National Quantum Initiative Center. So I'm part of the co-design center for quantum advantage together with Yale and IBM and Brookhaven National Lab and MIT and many, many other partners. And I just started talking to the superconducting qubits guys and saying like, well, what have you tried? And then they would send me some papers and we kind of go back and forth. And the snarky point is I was like, oh, they haven't tried anything. it's all low hanging fruit. They've only tried like three superconductors, maybe four. Nobody has ever cleaned a surface. They've never even looked at what they have. So then I was like, okay, fine, we can try this for a little bit.
Maybe there's something you could do here. Yeah, but, yeah,
yeah.
Is that the genesis of sort of the use of tantalum instead of niobium? That's interesting because Pat Gooman was just telling me that story not too long ago, and it's a fascinating one, right? It has something to do with the number of oxides in niobium, is that right?
Yeah, well, okay, let me be totally transparent about this story. So it came out of an NSF grant, and you know, maybe this is a story about how NSF does great things, but it was a total lark. Basically, a group of us were just like, oh, we'll just put in for this random grant that says that we're going to look at new material systems and try to clean surfaces of superconducting qubits. And just as evidence of how dumb we were, the team is me, Pat, you know, at IBM, so we would have access to some devices, Victor Brar, who does STM at Wisconsin Madison, Bob Kava, who's a solid state chemist. And that's a great team. I'm really happy with that. And then as an unfunded collaborator, we added Andrew Houck. So we were like, oh, we don't really have to measure these things. We can just try some stuff. But anyway, so we had our kickoff meeting, and the five of us were sitting in a room. And we're like, okay, Andrew, tell us what you know. Tell us what your qubits are made out of. And he showed us his material system. And then, okay, my bias is you guys haven't tried anything. I'm sure all your surfaces are covered in junk. So we're just going to try to tackle that. And, you know, and maybe we'll try to strip off these oxides.
Gosh, where could the dielectric loss be coming from?
Yeah, exactly. And then Bob Kava, you know, came in and said, you know, I spent like a lot of the 80s studying the oxides of niobium, and niobium is a horrifically bad material system. You guys should definitely not be using that. Like, niobium will make different oxides if you just look at it funny, so there's no hope of controlling it. So I think you should go one down on the periodic table to tantalum. That was basically the genesis. So it was, you know, he had some general heuristics that tantalum should have a nicer oxide because people had made capacitors out of it, you know, in the microelectronics industry. But it was really just like, these oxides are terrible. These oxides are maybe better. Like, you should just try it. You guys don't try enough things. And then the very first qubit, and to tell you how little we thought this was going to work, Andrew handed this project to a new undergrad in his group, like a summer intern.
A summer intern. Said,
go get some commercial films of Tantalum. Let's just make a qubit out of it. And the very first qubit this guy made was the best qubit Andrew's group had ever made.
By an undergrad.
By like a factor of two. Yes. Well, and it was like this enormous signal. Yeah. Well, no, actually, Andrew sort of did the opposite, which was like, okay, now things got serious. So now let's assemble like an actual team.
That's a great story.
Great story.
Thank you for all that detail.
Just to put a slight point on it, so the issue with niobium, it's that there are a whole bunch of different types of oxides that it forms, and each one would have slightly different electronic characteristics. Is that right?
Okay, so I'm not willing to commit to what exactly is wrong with niobium because we haven't done super careful measurements, but the general argument is, okay, you have all of these different stoichiometries. Some of them are superconducting, some of them are insulating, some of them are kind of almost normal metals. And you just don't know what you have on your surface. And so you can have things like quasi-particle loss, and you know, it's usually catastrophic to just spray a normal metal all over your surface. And it's just very hard to characterize the dielectric loss. But what I'll say is, you know, since that work, I don't remember whose result. I think this is an IMEC result. Like they've done things like take niobium resonators on silicon, dip the entire thing in HF and stick it in the fridge as quickly as possible so that the oxides don't form back. And they get quality factors that are comparable to what we get in tantalum, right? So it's not a problem with the underlying material system.
It's you can either clean it or you can use a different material.
Yeah, exactly.
So Natalie, if I could just chime in for a sec. I mean, we try to track these issues with some care. It's so interesting, this detail. It's just so fun, these anecdotes. I mean, help our audience understand, because this theme keeps coming up in numerous interviews, not just you, on the very intense difficulty of surface physics, right, and surface chemistry in this domain. Can you perhaps unwind that for us a little bit for the audience? I'm just it feels as if it's a major challenge within the research agenda.
Yeah. Okay. So I think the story people would normally tell you about surfaces, which is not untrue, is that, you know, one, surfaces are really hard because they're just difficult to control. Like controlling a bulk material is, I would say that bulk synthesis techniques are also not super easy, but that's usually something that's upstream of you, like someone else has figured out. So they either deliver something of some material or not, but then the surface you can screw up in a billion ways because you have to polish it, or you're etching, or, you know, doing all kinds of things. And then what exactly you're left with is extremely history dependent and therefore very complicated. So that's the first part. And, you know, most materials have to be different at the surface than the bulk. Not every single material, but most materials. Like if you think about a diamond, which is near and dear to my heart, it's carbon atoms all the way through the bulk. But then when you get to the surface, you now have these, it can't be carbon all the way because carbon has to form four bonds. So it has to terminate with something. And then what exactly the surface looks like is sensitively dependent on what that termination is, if it's a mixture of things, you know, whether or not you've polished the surface correctly, all kinds of stuff. The other problem that I think most people are aware of is that it's hard to look at surfaces. So normally, if you're doing, you know, spectroscopy, it's kind of easy to shine a laser at something and look at bulk absorption.
You get a signal, yes, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem with a surface is that you're looking at this monolayer of atoms on top of an Avogadro's number of atoms in the bulk. So like, how are you going to pick out that signal? So there are a bunch of techniques that people have developed and won Nobel Prizes for and things like that over the century. And most of them involve taking advantage of the fact that some particle just doesn't travel very far in the surface. So you can do things like shoot X-rays in, eject electrons, and then the electrons only have a mean free path of, let's say, 10 nanometers. So if you put some selection on the kinetic energy, then you can make sure that you're only looking at like the top few nanometers of material, that kind of thing. Okay, but a lot of these techniques require things like ultra high vacuum, or you have to go to a synchrotron source. So it's like not that easy. It's not that easy to build up surface science stuff in your lab. So I think that's another reason that people sort of shy away from it.
Helpful background, thank you.
Yeah, but what I would say, so that's I think that's like the standard picture. But what I would say is the actual problem with it, and I don't know if this is generic to everyone or if this is just the quantum field. So maybe I should only talk about the quantum field because it's the one that I know. Is that I think a lot of people would like to just do A-B testing, you know? So what they want to do is try a thing and then say, okay, we tried it, and then we have this control, and then we look, you know, this thing has a longer lifetime than this thing, so it means that it worked. But the truth is that's, I mean, it's a very trivial point, but like losses add as like, you know, one over the quality factor, right? so you can change one thing, but if that's not the dominant thing, you're just not going to see, you're not going to see a delta. So, you know, if you do something, okay, like tantalum is a really good example. So we happen to see a really big delta because the oxides are so bad, but actually getting from that first device to the like world record breaking device was a lot of pain, because what you have to do is make sure that your fab isn't introducing like very rough edges and kind of weird surface morphology, and you have to clean the devices. Because if you just take your, you know, perfect metal that has these awesome properties and then deposit like 10 nanometers of hydrocarbons all over it, then all that you're measuring is those hydrocarbons. Then, so basically you can kind of increase the ceiling with some new material system, but then actually revealing that that's the ceiling is quite difficult to do.
So in other words, it's sort of another iteration of the, you know, 80% of the gain is 20% of the work, and the last 20% is 80% of the work. But getting that last bit is like mostly of the hard stuff.
Yeah, I mean, one of the analogies I found myself making actually just in subgroup meeting this morning is that it's a little bit like you're walking on a tightrope, and what you're trying to find is the higher tightrope to jump to. And there are a million ways to fall off of your tightrope, but that's not interesting, right?
That's not progress, yeah.
Yeah, that's just flat on the ground. You haven't learned anything from that. So it's sort of, it's a different mode of hypothesis testing than most people are used to for some reason.
Interesting. You mentioned that diamond is near and dear to your heart. I wonder, is there a way to sort of describe conceptually how a vacancy in diamond can be used as a two-level system or for a qubit or as a sensing device?
Oh yeah, sure. So the general picture is really straightforward. It's just that diamond has this very, very wide band gap. It's 5.5 eV, you know, this enormous window. And when you put defects into it, you tend to get very energetically deep defects, which means you get these really isolated electronic levels that are really, really far away from your band edges. And it turns out that there's a bunch of these defects that just look like molecules. You know, if you look at the electronic structure, it just looks like what you would get from group theory if you added up all of those atomic orbitals. So you sort of don't have to think about the fact that you're sitting inside this extended lattice, but instead you now have something that looks like a little atom or a molecule with, you know, atom or molecular degrees of freedom. So that means that you can do all of the same tricks that you pull in AMO, where you can optically prepare the spin, optically read out the spin, you know, prepare superpositions, coherent superpositions of spin states.
I'm sorry, Natalie, AMO, could you?
Atomic, molecular, and optical physics.
Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, you forget that people outside don't know all of the tribes.
We try to track them all, but we don't have them all under perfect command.
So I mean, a lot of the people who work on color centers and diamond, they come from that community, like people who would normally laser cool atoms in vacuum chambers, because it's a lot of the same techniques, except you just don't have to laser cool. You just have this thing sitting in the diamond kind of for free. So the general idea is that you use this spin as your qubit degrees of freedom. And then you can just use all of the same tricks that people have from like a century of spin resonance techniques like NMR or ESR, all these pulse sequences and everything. But then the really cool part about it is because you have this optical manifold of control, then you can also combine all of that spin resonance stuff with the last, I guess it's 30 to 40 years of single molecule imaging, right? People know how to make these microscopes that really focus down to the diffraction limit and isolate a single molecule or single atom. We have these amazing single photon detectors where you can, you know, you can detect really dim signals. So the idea is that you use one of these microscopes to look at a single center, and then you use microwaves to manipulate the spin, and then now you have optical readout of your qubit, you know, and you're really looking at a single qubit. So that's sort of the general coolness of color centers in diamond. The part that's uncool is that because it is this atomic defect in the solid state, it's very hard to imagine how you're going to make large-scale processors, right? Because now having controlled interactions between dozens of NV centers or whatever, like they have to be tiled in some perfect way. You need to control their positions with extreme precision. Even if you could do that, there are some outstanding questions about how exactly you would do the architecture for individual addressability and things like that. So I think, you know, I'm sure that I just pissed a lot of people off with this comment, but I think the real...
it's helpful for us, and I don't mean them any animus, but I mean, it does seem like it's very challenging to get to even a multi-qubit architecture, let alone an advanced gate system that would, you know, run the entire QC. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. So I think the real killer apps are things like you can use them as sensors, right? So now,
absolutely.
Now, right. you have this long-lived qubit. It's sitting at a very particular place. People have demonstrated really high magnetic field sensitivities that rival some of the best alternative technologies. But then you're really in this like nanoscale volume, so you can do things that look a lot like magnetic resonance imaging, but at, you know, angstrom scales. So that's, you know, one of the things that a lot of people are working on. The other killer app is quantum networks, because you now can connect spin and photon degrees of freedom, and you're in the solid state, so you have the potential to integrate with integrated nanophotonics. And that's why some of the most sophisticated demonstrations of, you know, long distance networks, like this beautiful work that Ronald Hansen is doing at Delft, where they entangle, you know, two NV centers that are a few kilometers apart, that kind of thing. You know, those are built on color centers in diamond.
So totally naive question. Why is it called a color center?
Oh, just because it looks colorful.
Okay.
If you Google search, you know, just like,
oh, they're beautiful images. In diamond.
you can okay. See all of these gemstone
so
images.
No connection with quantum chromodynamics then in the theory.
No.
Okay.
No, this is a very old term. You can find it's this field that has been subsidized by De Beers for a very long time, which is like, you know, do random spectroscopy and stuff in diamond, and people have been characterizing color centers in diamond for forever.
Right. Very cool. That's such an interesting little link to gemology then, I guess.
Maybe given the time, this might be a good time to pivot towards your science paper and talk about that. It's possibly an adjacent topic. Yeah, the scope of that paper included color centers, but also a bunch of other fundamental, you know, new material science foundations for quantum information processing. I guess what was the title? It was Materials, Challenges, and Opportunities for Quantum Computing Hardware. I'm wondering, is there any way to give a decent, concise overview of the major findings there for our audience?
Yeah. So,
huge topic,
well,
I get it.
It's a huge enough topic that I think we got back a 27-page long review.
Oh, wow.
Maybe I can like turn your question around a tiny bit and tell you a little bit more about like the genesis of the review paper. So basically, David Steuermann, who was at the Kavli Institute at the time, and now he's at IonQ, sort of got this group together as part of a session, an invited session at MRS that was like, you know, tell us about the material challenges in all of your different platforms. I don't know exactly how the sausage got made here, but basically a science editor got really interested in this topic and then asked exactly that group of people to, you know, to put together a comprehensive review. So Hani Pike at IBM was, you know, largely responsible for kind of keeping this group together and assembling it. And essentially, you know, initially I said, look, I'm about to have a baby. I can't do this. I can do my little section on color centers because that will take me no time, but I'm not going to participate in this general thing. And they were like, that's fine. Give us your little center, your little section on color centers. And sure enough, the little section on color centers probably only took me a day and a half to write because it's just my bread and butter. And then I came back out of, not exactly out of maternity leave. I think my kid was like 2 months old or something. And then I said, okay, how's writing going? And they're like, we have not done anything. So then I actually got to rejoin this project. And then the kind of neat thing was that that gave me an opportunity to shape a little bit what we were doing. And what we sort of collectively decided was that one thing that would be really helpful for the community is to show your work. Because in a lot of these fields, there are all of these things that people say, you know, like, oh, we know that it's a real problem if you do this. But then they don't say how they know it. And it really turns out that it's just, oh, because my advisor told me when I was a postdoc like 10 years ago, right? And you have no idea where that piece of information originated. So what it ended up turning into was that me as an outsider still to superconducting qubits, you know, we had just started our tantalum work at the time. So I had a lot of interest, but I was definitely, I mean, I'm still not an expert, but I was definitely not an expert. You know, Hani, you know, and Ben Palmer basically just let me grill them on, okay, you say that you know that there's flux noise everywhere. How do you know that? And then we like drilled down into the literature and, you know, produced this thing. So the thing that I'm really proud of in that paper is that everything is backed up. Everything is very solid and explains how do we know the things that we think we know. So that was the main aim, was here's the current understanding in each of these platforms. Here's what people think in trapped ions that leads to anomalous heating and, you know, these problems that they see. Here's the issue with quantum dots, right? But it specifically points to, and here's the experiment that somebody did that is convincing, that shows us that this is a thing.
Well, and it seems like there's an element of exactly what you said at the very beginning of sort of reaching up into the application, the intended application of the material to understand what the critical sort of characteristics and constraints are, and then feeding that back into the fundamental research into the materials and the fabrication itself.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, none of these things make sense in a vacuum. You always have to connect them to some, you know, ultimate application.
Yeah, but pretty interesting. You did more of an exposition, right, of the tradecraft of each of these individual subdomains. Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah. I'm wondering, I mean, from this overview, I mean, are you willing to make any daring, I don't know, projections or speculations of which of the underlying platforms are nearing a breakthrough moment? I mean, I know that's a gigantic speculative guess I'm asking you to make. I'm so curious to know your perspective.
Yeah, it's funny because it's especially treacherous from an internal politics standpoint because...
All right, well, I don't want you to get into that minefield.
No, I'm willing to wade into the minefield.
Oh, good, okay. I'll go in.
Princeton is a pretty unique place in that we have all of these people who are working on quantum information in very different platforms. You know, at a lot of universities, you'll have like one specific platform that's really strong, and then not a lot of presence in others. But here we have superconducting qubits, we have color centers in Diamond, we have neutral atom quantum computers, we have quantum dots, we have Majorana fermions, we have, you know, quantum gas microscopes, we have molecules, we have electrons on helium. And one of the things that's been really great about that is we all sit around and learn from each other, right? Like people have come up with new schemes for their platforms, staring down the hall and saying like, well, what is a superconducting qubit? Like, what exactly are those guys doing? But then the funny kind of side effect of this is that we're constantly lobbing bombs at how what other people are doing is clearly not going to work. And so it means that my brain is just filled with what the best arguments against each platform is, or at least the snarkiest argument. So, you know, superconducting qubits are very cool, and I think we're going to do really interesting things with them. The two things that bother me right now are one that doesn't seem that fundamental, which is that they're really huge. Like transphones are really gigantic. They're like the size of a human hair. It's really hard to imagine getting
right
to
a million of them. Yeah.
Yeah. A million.
They're like
of
a millimeter in size, right? Each one.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not fundamental. That is like a materials problem, right? If you could fix the materials, you could make them smaller. But the other issue is like the connectivity is so you know, is so tough that you have to spend all of this time doing these swaps, and then the swaps have to be made up of like CDOTs. Like, it's sort of like the worst possible way to move information around. Neutral atoms actually look pretty good. I think Jeff is going to be really excited to hear me say this, but that's a platform that I remember just, let's see, I can always bookmark things by when my kids were born. So this was, Penny was one. So this would have been the end of 2019. I remember, you know, my postdoc advisor giving interviews where he was like, oh, well, we could just make a quantum computer out of neutral atoms, and thinking like, that's ridiculous.
Well, you said you spent some time with Misha's group too. So, I mean, they've now spun out a commercial.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's who I'm talking about.
Right? That's what I figured.
You know, Misha was saying, we're making a programmable quantum computer. And I thought, Misha, come on, you know, this is all really beautiful work, but I don't know if this is going to be a quantum computer. And I will totally say, like, I will eat my hat. Like, it's, you know, it's only been 3 years. My kid is just almost four. And now, like, they look like the biggest, baddest kids on the block. You know, they're doing beautiful things. It looks like there's this enormous ceiling on that technology. And I'm super bullish on neutral atoms. But then at the same time, trapped ions, you have, trapped ions are very slow. That's always the problem. But they're making logical qubits. I mean, that's amazing, right? You wouldn't have thought just a year ago if you said, oh, we're going to make our first logical qubit in under a year. Nobody would have said that. Maybe I just painted a positive picture about everything. I meant to paint a negative picture about everything.
No, but this is, it's really useful because it's an overwhelming amount of contrasting factors of advantages and disadvantages for the different technologies. So this is a useful context. Thank you.
Yeah, very, very. And before I forget, I meant to mention or ask you, so you said trapped ions are slow. At least I've heard that that's one of the challenges with diamond vacancies as qubits is the slowness of being able to sort of manipulate and read the state. Is that true?
So at room temperature, this is always like a little bit hidden under the hood. At room temperature, you get extremely few photons per shot. So all of those beautiful, you know, coherent oscillation curves at room temperature, those are like millions of averages. So the readout is actually quite difficult. At low temperatures, though, you have other possibilities. But the real problem is the two qubit gates. That's the real issue. So, you know, you have to have dipolar interactions. Then, you know, how are you going to tile this and make, how are you going to do more than a single pair, basically?
Right. Okay. And so, as you said, probably sensing initially until and if we sort of figure out those bigger problems.
Which I gather does not demand a multi-gate requirement.
Yeah. Well, and once you're not trying to build like a large-scale quantum processor, there are other clever things you can do. Like if you wanted to make an entanglement enhanced sensor, you could take advantage of the fact that there are all these little nuclear spins sitting around the NV center, and then use those as this little quantum register. A lot of those protocols were really pioneered by, you know, for example, Liang Zhang, who's now at University of Chicago, like wrote down some very elegant schemes for being able to take advantage of these nuclear spins.
That's really cool. So I'm mindful of time, but I did want to mention and give you a chance to talk about the way that we met, which was over the QRIP program, the internship program that Princeton and IBM do collaboratively. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your view is. I think programs like that are super important, and especially in terms of opening the aperture and for inclusion and diversity in this field. You know, STEM does not and STEM and the technology industries in general do not have a great track record for diversity and inclusion. What's your sort of view on? I mean, it feels like quantum as a forming field is an opportunity to maybe right some of those wrongs and do things a little bit differently. Are there things that you think either educators or industry participants in this stage of quantum computing and quantum information technologies in general can do to sort of help, you know, make this one work better than the other fields have in the past?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I have any grand solutions, but I can speak to my specific experience through QRIP and other things. I'm immensely proud of QRIP. So the whole, I guess for people who have never heard of it, the whole idea is that the students spend, it's a 12-week program, and they spend 6 of those weeks at Princeton doing, basically academic research, summer internship kind of stuff with one of the groups here. And then they spend 6 weeks at IBM paired with a mentor working on a project there. So the thing that, the reason that we started it was that in talking to kind of our undergrads, I realized that they really see their summers as this precious resource. And they were very stressed out about the fact that that meant that they had to choose between, academic work and industry work, and they wanted to be able to sample everything. So it was clear that there would be like a lot of demand for this kind of program. And then I think all of the art was in figuring out how to do it without making it be a shallow experience at both places, right? Because 6 weeks is such an accelerated time frame. So the only way that you can do it is with a lot of intensive mentoring. So what we do is, it's intensive mentoring paired with the fact that we select students that are pretty well prepared to begin with. That doesn't mean that they know anything about quantum. It just means that they at least have had some research experience and are academically excellent, so that we know that they have the tools to be able to hit the ground running. So sort of like the best possible QRIP applicant is somebody who, is awesome in a variety of ways, and then was like, a plasma physicist or something, and has a paper in plasma physics, like something totally unrelated. And they're like, well, I would really like to give this quantum thing a shot. And that way, we get to draw people into our field. But basically what we do with them on the faculty side is in the month or two before they show up at Princeton, we do things like directed readings. To get them up to speed and to really help them formulate, what the project is going to look like here, and pair them, with students and postdocs who are going to be really responsible for, training them in lab or on the specific techniques. And I think that really active mentorship is just such a different mode from, normal summer programs are just like, okay, show up in my lab and I'm going to ignore you for the next 3 months.
sink or swim. Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like when you say mentorship, you also mean like a multi-party mentorship. There's a whole support mechanism built up around each QRIP participant, right? I mean, fellow students.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah. That's great.
That's right. And they form a cohort that's very tight. Like from what I've heard, even our first cohort in 2019, they're all still in touch with each other. When they all applied to grad school together, they, asked, oh, what are you guys doing? And still keep in touch with each other. And then the other thing that we do while they're here is we have a bunch of mentoring lunches. So in addition to the stuff that's like, okay, what are you going to do for research and trying to get them up to speed there? We just have them, in a room with the other QRIP interns and one person, 1 year, like Steve Gervin came. And I really just wanted to like sit through that thing because I wanted to hear what Steve had to say.
Yeah, we just talked to Steve last week.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. But I left the room so that they could ask all of their questions without feeling self-conscious. And then they get to hear all of these people's individual stories and, ask the tough questions about like, how do you pick a research program and how did you get into this? And the thing that I'm maybe most proud of locally is that I had this amazing student, just like incredible student. And he was just like I won't even go into all the details of how he was such a powerhouse, but he was just such a powerhouse. He's way smarter than I am. And he showed up, solved all this stuff, cracked open this program, like this whole thing that's turned into this whole research program in my group. And then at the end of the summer, gave me one of the best compliments I've ever been given, which is that he said, this was so great. Working with you has, on this project has been so inspiring and has given me the confidence that I could totally do this. And I'm like, how did you not have the confidence? Like, you're obviously amazing. But I think he had never had close enough mentorship to finish a thing or something. Like, he had never gotten to that stage where you're like, oh, that's what it looks like to do a science, right?
And that can be so rare in these academic programs. I mean, decent guidance and mentorship, right? I mean, often enough, it is kind of a sink or swim thing. So yeah, it's an amazing program, really. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much for your time, Natalie. Anything you'd like to end off on? Anything we didn't catch in our agenda, in our conversation?
Oh, gosh. I think I already got myself into enough trouble.
We can give you final edit if you need it. No, I think it's all been fairly tame, but who knows? But yeah, this has been terrific. It's been super, super fun talking with you and really, really interesting.
So grateful for your time. Really, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
That was so fun. I tell you, you know, what really stood out for me, there was a quote from Wolfgang Pauli that was mentioned in our last interview with Steve Gervin that I thought was right. So apropos, this whole discussion, right? It's a great quote. It goes, "God made the bulk, but the surface was invented by the devil." And it just seems like that's such a tough frontier for many of the outcomes for these experimental apparatuses. And, you know, that big breakthrough her group pioneered with tantalum, I think really underlines that same quote. So
absolutely. And also just bringing that type of deep understanding of surfaces, of materials and how they are deposited, how they interact with one another. You know, it seemed like bringing a materials perspective to the quantum science and engineering conversation had some extremely low-hanging fruit. I mean, she said, you know, there hadn't been a lot of experimentation at the material level, and there hadn't been a lot of honing of the techniques to clean and prepare surfaces. So I think that there's really exciting possibilities in immediate gains for applying Professor De Leon's sort of perspective here.
No doubt. Yeah, pretty cool. I think it was also just so cool to hear how the Princeton team, it's got this huge diversity in different research avenues pioneered by different principal investigators for various different platforms for this, you know, quantum information science technologies. And so they're able to, you know, in a friendly academic way, you know, compete and compare and contrast these different technologies and debate about what's going on and what are the problems and how they can get beyond. So very, very interesting department over there. There's clearly poised for yet more big breakthroughs.
Absolutely. And that type of diversity of thought is probably one of the most crucial ingredients for finding the path forward for quantum information science and engineering as a field, because certainly nobody has all the answers today. So having as broad a field of inquiry as possible seems like the only rational strategy to me.
Well, thanks again to Natalie for your time. I know it's very precious. And wow, that was really fun. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Till next time.
Okay, that's it for this episode of The New Quantum Era, a podcast by Sebastian Hassinger and Kevin Roney. Our cool theme music was composed and played by Omar Costa Hamido. Production work is done by our wonderful team over at PodFi. If you are at all like us and enjoy this rich, deep, and interesting topic, please subscribe to our podcast on whichever platform you may stream from. And even consider, if you like what you've heard today, reviewing us on iTunes and/or mentioning us on your preferred social media platforms. We're just trying to get the word out on this fascinating topic and would really appreciate your help spreading the word and building community. Thank you so much for your time.